Welcome to the second part in this series, Hidden Worlds, where today we're taking to the coast. I'm pretty sure that just like me, all of you out there realise just how lucky we are to have the awesome Atlantic on our doorsteps. And we probably all love different things about it and use it in lots of different ways. Well, that might actually be a recurring theme in today's Hidden Worlds. I'm going to be skimming along different parts of our coast with Declan Feeney, Bill Crowe, Fionn Murphy and Iiski Britton. And while they were all pointing out the varied and tenacious life connected with this habitat, they also opened my eyes to how these coastlines and the life that's found there contribute to our health and wealth.
We are in one of my favourite habitats. We are in the sand dune system, which is a special area of conservation because it's so special. But apart from the legislation, it's one of the most fantastic places to go.
I'm sure my first stop, Strigia North Sligo, is probably well loved by many of you. And I met Declan Feeney, an ecologist from IT Sligo here. While idyllic summer days may have sprung to mind, Declan showed it to me in a completely new way, revealing it as a bafflingly unpredictable habitat with a huge range of factors affecting the life that we find here. And that might start with a tiny plant or invertebrate species, but these unassuming stepping stones go on to determine the more obvious living creatures that we find further up the food chain.
Sand dune systems are incredibly dynamic. They move, they change, they form, they disappear, and that can happen in 24 hours. Okay. And it's the most incredible change in such a short period of time. So if you walk down to a local beach with a sand dune system today, you might find that there's lots of sand or maybe very little. But if you go back tomorrow, lots of sand could have disappeared overnight. Our sand dune system could be completely changed. And usually it's because of storms. They can take hundreds, if not thousands of tons of sand and move it from one location to another. And every habitat or every species within this habitat has adapted to those quick changes. So all the plants, all the animals, everything from bird life down as far as snails, plants, they all move with the sand dune system. And that makes it incredibly dynamic. There's really no other habitat like that. So if you can imagine you're standing at the point where the tide is fully in and you put your back to the sea and you walk inland. On most sand dune systems, you'll come across not just one type of habitat, but within about 30 metres, you'll walk through three, maybe four habitats. Well, you're actually standing on a beach, and that's a habitat in itself.
Is there much living there on that sandy beach?
It depends on how exposed it is. Like for here in Strida, we do get, in the winter, we get sanderling that come and they feed on small invertebrates that are along the water's edge. We might have what we call sandhoppers, but we could be saltwater shrimp, so very small ones. They might be sprat on the edge of the water. But then you also get gulls, and they'll scavenge whatever they can along the shoreline. So we don't have a huge amount. But then as you walk beyond that, the first thing you come to is what they call the embryonic dunes, and they're usually very low. They're only about maybe a metre high, and they're small. And they're effectively the dunes that are wind-blown sand, because as the tide goes out, the wind pushes the sand, and it kind of gathers in small areas. There's very little vegetation in that spot as well. But beyond that, that's when you come to the white dunes or the marram dunes. And that's where, you know, you find in Strandhill or in Strida, there are those big dunes and they kind of move slowly. The wind blows the sand up through them and it lands the far side and it gradually gathers. Because the sand is loose and it flows, a lot of the plants there, they'll move with it. They'll kind of grow through the sand dune system. So marram grass is a really prime example. It uses runners to run through the sand. And as the sand fills in, and for example, if it was to actually increase in height in a sand dune, the marram grass will continue to grow up through it and it'll hold on and hold the shape. But actually some of the species are actually really, really good at holding together sand and building a sand dune system. And marram grass is the predominant one. And effectively we've planted marram grass since the 16th century in a lot of our sand dune systems to stabilize them. So the planted marram grass grows, holds together and binds the sand and holds the sand. Because without it, what happens is, of course, the sand, well, we get a thing called a blowout, where the sand would get into an area, the wind would get into an area and blow the sand out and continue to blow it out. So if anyone's familiar with Strandhill and they go to the Shelley Valley, that's a major, massive blowout that's been there for decades at this stage. And if you go there on a very windy day, you'll see the sand shifting through it, blowing through it. But that sand then blows up and it drops down, usually gets caught in the marram grass, and the marram grass starts to hold that sand. And gradually over time, the ground starts to change, so it becomes a little bit more organic in nature. So you can see it going from a white colored dune to what they call a gray colored dune, which means it's more organic material, more humus material. When you get to those dunes, you're going from just marum to having different types of grasses. You'll have different types of flowering plants. You'll possibly have orchids present. In summer, it'll be a carpet of color, and it'll be a massive carpet of different colors and different species all across it. And they can get washed away, of course, if they're exposed to maybe big storms. And what happens is gradually over time, they replace themselves and they build again. We'll sometimes even get the Irish lizard. We do have lizards in Ireland. Most people don't see them because lizards are really good at staying out of the way because they really don't want to get possibly eaten by something bigger. But they would use these. Then beyond the lizards, you're going to actually start to see lots of bird life. And then you'll also find that we'll have hares, rabbits, foxes. Otters will use these locations, and then you can have birds of prey that are feeding on the likes of the lizards, and maybe even mice and shrew that you would find in locations like this. So Streeta has been noted for the likes of the merlin, but also sparrowhawk, and we do get buzzards that pass overhead, and all those species are all ones that will be hunting. So sand dune systems are alive with life, and we sometimes walk through them and think, oh, it's just sand and marum grass, but really there's lots and lots of species using it. And then beyond that, again, here we are in Streeta, we're suddenly hitting stone and cobble, and we're into the estuary side. And those areas actually get colonized by some really interesting plants that can survive immersion in salt water for periods, dried out for long periods, and they're usually quite waxy in nature. And they're very, very unique to habitats that are on the estuary side of sand dune systems. And then you're into the estuary. So that's four or five habitats, all within 30 meters. And each one of them have their own specific biological and physical properties.
Now, I know that that probably is a lot to take in, and I wasn't finished yet. Next, I met Declan's colleague, Bill Crow, and learned about biotopes, which is the scientific name for a group of specific organisms that normally live together in a particular spot. Now, the biotopes in the rock pools here are being constantly exposed to shifting tides and weather, and that means that the seemingly small world of a rocky outcrop here at the end of Streeta Beach is actually a tangle of continuously competing and exchanging life.
You'll find species that are always there, but if you came back the next day or maybe a month or two later, the same species may not be sitting on the same part of the rock. They're interchanging. What could happen is if you had a storm that washed everything off the shore, the first thing that came in would depend on chance. It would depend what's in the larvae that are in the plankton. So say an algae was in the plankton, it might settle down as sea lettuce or something, and then the limpets would come in and start eating it. Next thing it might settle would be a barnacle, and the barnacles would try to take over the place. The dog whelks would come in and start eating them. So this sort of cycling is going on all the time. So in one particular area you'll have a group of maybe 10 or 15 species that are always interacting with one another, and all they'd all be living on different spots on the rocks but interchanging with time.
Down at the other end of the shoreline, at the very lowest ebb of the tide, you'll find the sea rods.
On the west coast of Ireland, in the winter months, we get massive storms, and maybe not every winter, and what happens is we end up with these massive tides, which are connected with the moon, and they rise higher at the full moon and the new moon, and they are not quite in the neap tides in the mid-cycle of the moons. That combined with wind and large storm waves, which we can get up to 12 to 14 meter sea swells here in northwest Ireland, which can translate into massive waves breaking on the beach here in Streeta. And of course that draws surfers, but that's the energy that they're surfing effectively, and that energy can change the entire sand dune system. It can scour out the beach, it can expose stones, and then what's more, it can actually do, it can lift rocks from quite deep water and bring them in. And here in Streeta actually it's quite unique. We find that you get flat rocks thrown up onto the beach, and what happens is during the summer months kelp beds grow just offshore, and the kelp beds attach to big flat rocks, but as the kelp grows it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. It gets to a point that come autumn time that there's so much kelp holding one rock that the kelp floats the rock off the shore and up onto the sand dune system. So you suddenly find on the beach, you find this huge pink piece of kelp and the stone stuck to the bottom of it. Yeah. So a lot of the stones we have in Streeta are ones that have actually been drawn out by kelp beds as they get washed up onto the during the summer months and autumn months. So we've got this one or two stony gravel banks, and a lot of those stones are ones that have been pulled in by kelp. So kelp moves the stones, and then the stones grind off each other. That creates sand, and we also get shells from snails and other invertebrates. So we end up with a sandy beach. And then the sand, of course, when you have a low tide, you get an exposed beach, dries out, wind picks up the sand blows. The sand blows up into the sand dunes get higher. So if you're on a beach on a windy day, you can see these huge plumes of sand lifting up off the sand dune systems.
Ecologist Fionn Murphy told me a little more about kelp as we scoured Dunmore and Strand, where huge mounds of kelp can often be seen on the beach.
Anybody that walks or swims on this beach regularly would know that it is always covered in kelp. So you can see the sea rods all over here across the sand and the stones. Can you tell me a little bit about the kelp itself?
Well, yeah, sure. And of course we can smell it as well as seeing it. It's quite a pungent aroma. But yeah, kelp is quite an interesting one. It's super fast growing. Certain species can grow up to a half meter a day, which is just incredible. And it does suit the sort of temperature ranges we get around Irish waters. You know, it never gets that low, particularly with the Gulf Stream coming up. So yeah, it's quite perfect, and it's a brilliant habitat. Provides a lot of shelter for so many different species, and for grazers as well. They can actually do a real number on kelp. They keep it back quite a lot, and actually an unexpected sort of danger to kelp is overfishing. So if you take away the larger fish which would feed on potential grazers, then the grazers can go unchecked and really do some damage. But yeah, it's also perhaps an underutilized resource. Like, all species of Irish kelp are edible. Now, some would be more enjoyable than others, and they are very nutritious. That's certainly for sure. I know with seaweed in general, people have been experimenting quite a lot with using it as cattle feed, or often in the rockier areas to the northwest of Ireland and Scotland, and Aran Islands in particular, the locals used sort of a mix of seaweed and sand to create their fields, essentially. There was no soil to grow crops. So seaweed's really useful in that aspect of things. It's a massive resource, it grows like crazy, and it is probably an underutilized resource. And of course, the historically important an activity was to burn it for sodium carbonate. That's sort of what comes out. And it's also a great source of iodine, which we don't really get occurring naturally too much in our diets, particularly for people who don't like fish. The great size of kelp means that it's it can cater to, of course, a broad variety of about fish and lower animals. In general, you get at different sections of the shore, you get a completely different sort of seaweed habitat, and specific species have their niche within that.
Now, I don't know if you picked up on what Fionn said there about Irish research into the fact that adding kelp to cattle fodder might offer a solution to reducing methane emissions from farming. In the same vein, Bill Crowe pointed out that medical researchers across the world are also turning to our coasts, but their target is the humble sea sponge.
They're the first of the multicellular animals. They don't have nerves or skeletons or anything like that. And the thing is, they've been around since long before the dinosaurs. They've been around since the beginning of animals on the seashore. They're very important because what they do is they sit on the rock for long periods of time. They could be sitting there for a few hundred years maybe. And things are trying to attack them. They produce chemicals. There's chemical warfare going on, and they stop things from settling beside them. A lot of the chemicals are coming from bacteria that are living inside them. And because of this, there's a lot of research being done in places like the Barrier Reef in Australia, where they're looking at sponges as the chemicals from sponges, a bit like the penicillin is a fungus that can be used to attack bacteria. You can also use the chemicals that come from sponges to attack bacteria as well. These have been found useful in cancer treatments, because cancers are cells growing out of control. And also, they might be useful for some of the bacteria resistance to drugs. A lot of countries are going out harvesting all sorts of sponges, bottling them and keeping them so that they can do some study on them.
So, sea sponges might be leading the way. But in fact, even as we speak, there are any amount of scientific researchers busily investigating a mind-boggling array of connections between human health and the sea.
We do have the option of just not using our cars every day. We have the option of carpooling, we have public transport, and if possible, you can cycle. Because I suppose this is the future we have. We're left with whatever this generation gives us. So I think that's why the strike was so powerful.
Yeah, and generally, all three of you, do you think change is underway?
I think they're starting to listen. I think they need to listen an awful lot more, really, but it's a start.
Cynics may say that it's not happening, but the science is there and they're just being oblivious. They just need to open their eyes.
Now, that's a clip of Sligo school students speaking about climate change on Ocean FM. And, well, they might.
This sand dune system protects the estuary, but also protects all the land the far side. So these type of systems, these ecological systems, are all around Ireland, and they're incredibly important because they're a first line of defence against large storms and big changes in our climate. And actually, they worry about losing some of these systems with climate change for the simple reason that a lot of these habitats protect not only towns but big cities and also lots and lots of coastland that we live in and we exist in. So we're using them as our kind of our first line of defence. I've been lucky enough to be at many sand dune systems around the world, mainly because I've been surfing for a long time, and I've probably been on the Irish sand dune systems the most because I've spent so much time surfing over the years, I'm afraid. But I've seen the changes over the last 30 years, and climate change is affecting sand dune systems because we are seeing a very, very small incremental rise in the oceans, but that small incremental rise is increasing and will continue to increase. So sand dune systems are very low. They're sitting only a couple of meters above sea level, and they're the first line of defense, especially if we get bigger storms during this change in our climate. And we are seeing those odd bigger storms more often. So the 50-year storms are 20-year storm, now 20-year storms. The 1 in 20-year storms are 1 in 5-year storms. The interesting thing about sand dune systems is every now and again, because we get those once in 50-year storms, they may change, but they will come back because there's this long period of recovery afterwards. But when those 1 in 50 year storms become 1 in 10, and there's another storm that comes after that, that's when we see those changes. We saw that a number of years ago, actually about 10 years ago in Strandhill, where we saw one massive area of the sand dune system just to the south of the prom in Strandhill disappear over a weekend. On Friday it looked like there was a storm coming, and by Monday the storm had passed and so had most of the sand dune system. And actually we had to spend a lot of our taxpayers' money to try and put in a structure, which I'm not sure if it actually worked. We have a point where we have to decide, what do we do? We like to go to these places. We don't want to see them change too much. And the problem with some of these hard structures, these real hard physical structures like concrete and stone, sand dune systems, as I've been saying, they move and they move in their own dynamic way. But once you start putting fixed, hard concrete structures in the middle of a sand dune system, the sand dune system either accelerates its loss around it, or it builds up more sand on another side. So it's a chance. It's a bit of a roll of a dice. You end up cutting off the sand dune system from its dynamic process of change. And sand dune systems need to be able to move on their own right. When they can't, what happens is they become more dysfunctional in nature. You don't tend to have that sort of changing natural structured system that we would see.
Admittedly, it can be hard to tune into subjects of this scale, but they are important connections to make for our coasts.
We've only a handful of birds.
But you can hear them.
But you can hear them. I think we've got curlew off in the distance. They could be bar-tailed godwits. There may be brent geese off further out in the mud flats, and the sand flats.
Now, hard as it might be, I'm turning my back on Streeta's beautiful beach with its mesmerising waves to look towards Benbulbin and take in the river estuary at the other side of the dunes.
If you're on the estuary side or on the seaside, the tide goes in and goes out twice a day. All the species, they don't have an alarm clock to tell them the tide's coming in, because they must know that the tide comes in, and it varies by about 50 minutes to an hour every single day. So twice a day they're completely exposed, possibly dried out, and then twice a day they're completely flooded or possibly underwater. So they have to adapt to that. So some creatures develop an ability to be able to get, you know, underground if it's dried out, or maybe they've got a special sort of coating if they're a plant, like a seaweed, so it prevents them from being desiccated and from becoming dried out and dying. The difference between the beach side and the estuary side is, because it's so sheltered, you get lots more worms, lots more bivalves, which are the likes of, well, they can be clams and they can be oysters, and we sometimes farm them in estuaries, but Basically, estuaries are incredibly rich, and sometimes there's lots and lots and lots of really tiny snails and shells that are sitting in there, and they're ideal food for birds. And then you get algae that grows on top of them. So we have the likes of curlew, we also get in golden plover, but we also get in brent geese. On the seaside, we sometimes get eider duck as well. And we have what we call rafts of eider duck on the seaside, and they would dive and they'd feed. Actually, they feed on the likes of starfish, which they get on the seaside. On the estuary side, the likes of the curlew and the bar-tailed godwit, they would use their long bills to poke into the sand, and they'd take out possibly invertebrates, so the likes of shrimp, or they would take out small soft shells that they could get the mussels out of. They feed and they've adapted to suit the needs of the food that's around them. So the likes of the estuary birds, they tend to have longer legs, which means that they can walk on softer ground. They sometimes have long thin bills that they can poke into the sand, and some of the bills are curved up and some are straight and some are curved down in order to maximize the amount of food that they get. So we're probably familiar with the oyster catcher, which is a little black and white bird, and it's got a kind of an orangey bill, and you'll find them on football pitches, but you'll also find them on coastal systems as well, and that's quite a medium-sized bill. But the likes of the curlew or the bar-tailed godwit or the likes of the whimbrel, they're birds that have very long thin bills, and sometimes we tell them apart by the shape of their bill. But the idea is that they can poke way down into the sand, find what they want. In some cases they actually filter through the sand to find what they need, and then they take out the food. So their physical shape has adapted over time based on the foods that they're looking for, and they've adapted to estuaries. That's what they predominantly use. Our estuaries tend to get busier in winter time, because sometimes we see a lot more winter birds coming, and they feed on the estuaries during winter months, and then in summer months they may migrate back to where they breed. And that could be, in some cases it could be Iceland, it could be Greenland, it could be off into Europe or into Northern Europe. So estuaries are incredibly important.
Well, maybe we should take a listen to some of these birds. There's the plover, the red-throated diver, the curlew, the bar-tailed godwit, and the very distinctive oyster catcher. And you've guessed it, it's not all about birds here. Estuaries like this one have also been put to work for us.
The other use we have for the likes of estuaries here, and we have it here in Streda, is that we use them for getting rid of our waste. So Grange, thankfully, now has a sewage treatment plant, but up to about 2 years ago, the sewage treatment plant it had was grossly undersized for the population of the town. So it did a partial job of treating all the things we flushed down the toilet, but the estuary did the rest for us. So the estuary actually helped to purify a lot of the waste that we would put into the water.
And how does that work? I mean, what is it in the estuary itself? Is it just diluting what goes in, or are there other things working?
You've got dilution factor for sure, but beyond that you've also got lots of bacteria, viruses, smaller little bugs. You can get things called rotifers and all sorts of other very, very small invertebrates, right up as far as snails and all sorts of aquatic species, and they eat the organic material. They're not picky. They see it as food. But obviously, we have to make sure that if we're using estuaries, we use them in a very safe, sustainable way, so that they're not just productive for today, but they're productive for the future as well. We've been very fortunate to get away with it. But once we put a sewage treatment plant in place, it does improve the water in the estuary itself, and that's good for all. We are passing this environment on. There's a value on it that's beyond a monetary value. And in scientific terms, we sometimes call it a bequest value. We're passing it on to the next generation.
The soils here by the shore have also been used by farmers for generations.
The lands around estuaries and around sand dune systems tend to be quite sandy in nature, which means they're really good for drainage. They can actually be farmed throughout the entire year. Some people have said that those type of fields work themselves as opposed to have to be worked. And we've had low intensive farming for many, many generations on sand dune systems, and particularly this one in Streda, it's a commonage. And sand dune systems can take a certain amount of farming, but farming has to be within the balance of the ecosystem itself. So you've got farming and farming communities that want to continue to use sand dune systems, but they've got the large number of people now using sand dune systems and beaches as this recreation location. So this is an area that we need to navigate for the future, because we find that these locations get busy with traffic, especially on Saturdays and Sundays in the middle of summer. It can prevent farming communities maybe accessing land. That can be a challenge, and that can be a flashpoint. It means that it can make things more difficult for both communities. Farming are getting a lot from sand dune systems, which is part of the ecosystem services. Public are using beach systems. They get a lot from the beach, and that's, again, public, free ecosystem services. So in both cases, things probably have to change slightly to accommodate each other. If we want to continue to use sand dune systems and beaches like we are currently using them, we need to invest in that infrastructure. We need to put in paths so people can get to the beach and from the beach. We need to put in facilities for them. But we need to actually do that in such a way that we take them away from sensitive areas. Go a path, have a dedicated path that you travel. Try and stay off a lot of the open marram dunes. There might be paths through them. Stick to the path. Don't make new paths. Quad bikes and all sorts of vehicles, they should not be on sand dune systems and shouldn't be on beaches. And then, of course, the obvious thing is when you're on a beach, when you have your day, make sure you tidy up all your stuff. Take all your litter with you. And if you want to be really good, why don't you take an extra bit that maybe somebody else forgot or they just missed? And if there's a little bit of waste that's been washed in, some plastic that's come in off the sea, you know, the three for the sea is a very good thing to do. Take the three, bring them home. Be conscious of the beach and try and kind of leave it the way we found it.
So if we all follow Declan's very practical advice, hopefully we can look forward to enjoying warmer and sunnier times by the sea for generations to come. I know it's hard to imagine now at the dark turning of the year, but try tuning into this next sound and you might just magic yourself there for a few seconds.
If you go to any sand dune system in springtime, you'll hear a meadow pipit and you'll also hear skylarks. And skylarks are this distinctive call that are the sound of spring to me. They are the arrival of the summer months coming. And they rise above the sand dune systems, make this glorious noise and settle back down. And basically they're mating, nesting. They're going to actually breed in the sand dune systems and then hopefully they'll be back. And actually in the wintertime they head up into the mountains.
Oh really?
Yeah. So we end up on a higher ground during wintertime and then they come down here during the summer. So they have a very short migration in the sense that they're usually within Ireland, but it's between coastal and mountain systems. Beyond that in the sand dune systems, you'll get lots of other smaller birds. And some of them actually will nest not only just in the sand dune systems and in the kind of the grassy areas, some will actually scoop a little bit of sand out and nest actually on the grass, on the sand, on the beach itself. So we have the likes of the plovers that will nest actually in open sand, not necessarily in streeted because it's very exposed to the sea, but the likes of Ross's Point have seen them nest there in the past. This time of the year you'll get a lot of the flowering plants, you'll still have the seed heads remaining. So we've got what looks like thistles and a few other different types of species here at the moment, and they're sitting in amongst the marram grass, and they would be ideal seed heads that birds would feed on. So you could get everything from some of your garden birds, the likes of the goldfinches, right through to the likes of some of the small grey birds. There's a dunnock and a few other different types of species that would use these sand dune systems the whole way through the year. Springtime, it gets a lot busier here. You end up with a lot of the other species of birds arriving in. You'll get meadow pipits, you'll get skylarks. You'll also have a lot of the smaller birds as well, but you might even get goldcrests, and you know, there's an array of them. And in some cases, they may nest in on the ground. So these are areas that are used, you know, by bird life as a nesting ground and an ideal kind of rearing ground for young in the spring and summertime, and then they may move in the wintertime.
It would make your heart glad to think of this beach in all its vibrant glory in a few short months' time. And as we close today, Easky Britain reminds us to tune in and enjoy it while still leaving room for all the plant and animal species that we share these spaces with. After all, we've got a flavour today of some of the many ways in which they are sustaining us, our health, our economies, and of course, in having fun.
I think one of the best, simplest ways, and even if you don't live right on the coastline, it is to start with the breath. I mean, it sounds so simple, but a few things about it. You know, they say every second breath we take, we're breathing in oxygen that was created from the ocean some 400 million years ago by tiny phytoplankton, these plants in the sea, which is just stunning. the ocean has created this environment that we can live in and most of the oxygen that we breathe. And also the breath is, it's our own inner cycle that mirrors natural cycles like the movement of tides, the wax and wane of the moon, the ebb and flow of the sea. So it's just that lovely reminder of how if we tapped into that energy more in our everyday lives, instead of kind of the push to sort of always be on, but allow there to be some more ebb and flow. But again, very simply, even taking, you know, 3 or 4 breaths to pause during the day is a lovely way to reconnect and know that when you do that, you're automatically connecting with the ocean.
And that's it for today. Next week, we'll be hitting the streets to uncover unusual corners of life in our urban spaces. I think you'll be delightedly surprised if you join us. So please tune in. Thanks for listening.